Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, my special guest is Caroline Bainbridge. Caroline is a professor of culture and psychoanalysis at Roehampton University and is a practicing member of the Analytic Network Coaching. She trained as an organizational consultant at the Tavistock Clinic, and Caroline has a profound fascination with psychoanalysis. She edits a book series on the theme of popular culture and psychoanalysis for Routledge. She's widely published in the field and a former editor of the journal Free Associations. Caroline, it's great to have you on the show. How are you today?
I'm really well, thanks, Simon. A bit sad to see the disappearance of the sun and the reappearance of the rain, but, you know, British summer's for you.
Where are you talking from? Which part of England?
I'm here in Liverpool at the moment, just not far from the beach with the Anthony Gormley statues on. So that's been a salvation the last few months or so.
They're wonderful, aren't they? I worked in Liverpool for a decade, and that beach and those statues as a sea kind of, for those who don't know, they're statues that are on the beach and the sea kind of washes over them. It's really moving, isn't it? Really powerful.
It's incredible. And you know, there are hundreds of them spread over 2 miles. Each one is the same cast iron figure of Gormley's own body. And yet every single one of them is different because of their relationship to the wind and the rain and the sea and the sand. And it's quite glorious. It's glorious.
Yeah. Humanity in all its forms. Caroline, you're interested in psychoanalysis and culture and the media, and I'm really excited to talk to you. Tell me, what got you interested in psychoanalysis in the first place?
Well, it's a long old time ago when I was an undergraduate. I was studying modern languages, and one of those languages was German. And in my final year at university, I was introduced to Freud, and I read, I remember very clearly, chapter 6 on the dream work from the interpretation of dreams. And I suddenly thought, why have I never heard about this before? It suddenly kind of gave me a new kind of set of languages and tools to kind of think about how to understand the workings of the mind and a sense of identity. So I was really curious about identity and how we understand self. So, and obviously I was interested in languages and language as a kind of key aspect of how we develop as human beings. So I got quite into that. And then following my undergraduate, I took a year out, went to Spain for a year, taught English, missed studying, and came back and did an MA in psychoanalytic studies at Sheffield. Uh-huh. And I kind of got stuck in to various different psychoanalytic traditions at that point and became quite fascinated with the Lacanian account of language and subjectivity. I know you're really interested in that yourself.
What do you think psychoanalysis brings? I mean, I'm like you. We're both fascinated with psychoanalysis and both kind of studied it from different perspectives, object relations to Lacanian and, you know, quite broadly. I mean, for me, it's very interesting. Some people kind of see it as an outdated kind of old fashioned, well, you know, not empirical. You can't measure it or prove it, and they question it. And yet, for me, almost because of that, it's more important. What's your kind of view of why psychoanalysis is important today?
I think that's a really good question. And you know, I hear what you're saying. That kind of the attack that's usually leveled is universalist, isn't it? And but I actually think that especially the object relations approach kind of avoids that charge because it's interested in our relationship to the world around us and the environment. So I'm quite interested in that. But I also think that psychoanalysis is really important as a framework to think ever more so. And right now at the moment in this very complex juncture in history, I think it's really, really crucial. And I think it's crucial because it does two things. Firstly, it gives us tools to understand how emotion and unconscious aspects of our experience regulate us and actually shape the way that we organize ourselves, organize our families, our friendship groups, our organizations. But it also allows us to get stuck into the messy bits, like the really complex bits of experience that can be quite contradictory and paradoxical. So what I like to think of in terms of the value of psychoanalysis is that it lets us have our cake and eat it. Mm-hmm. It lets us kind of, it's a kind of both and structure for me. So it can be contradictory. It allows us to sit with contradictions and to learn from them. Yeah. And I think that's a really valuable process, no matter, you know, I think the problems aren't there with every kind of structure of thinking around power and ideology and subjectivity and relationships and so on. You could level accusations at almost all of them in terms of
But
so for me, I kind of stick with it for those reasons.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. And it's a kind of the way it puts subjectivity at the heart and the emotional experience and our unconscious and our affective emotional experience, kind of our awareness and non-awareness. I mean, you talk about our cake and eat it. I think, you know, we can have our despair and our desire at the same time. I think it's...
Exactly. Yeah, it's a really good way of putting it. It's like, for me, it's the... to live with mess, you know, messiness. Yep, yeah. And to actually acknowledge that messiness is actually fundamental to what it is to be human.
That's right. That's right. And you apply it these days to media and culture. Say a bit more about your work in the university.
Yeah. So for the last 10 or 12 years or so, I've been working, as I said earlier, from the object relationships piece and thinking about how, as we've entered into this highly digitalized, highly technologized phase of history, we can't really get away from media. Media is absolutely everywhere, whether we like it or not. And I started really thinking about this and thinking that it's really fundamentally important to understand what this is doing to us psychologically, because I think it's restructuring the human mind. Christopher Bolas talks about this in a really interesting way in his recent book, Meaning and Melancholia. And he kind of formulates this idea of transmissive subjects and transmissive objects. And what he means by that is, if you think about the idea of a mobile phone and the way in which you might have your mobile phone in your hand, he gives an example of people turning up to a brunch in California, somewhere very glamorous. And, you know, they've got caught up in a traffic jam en route and they start telling the story of what happened. And then that one of the couple's phones pings and they get kind of, they drift out of that story and into the world of the phone, and their partner kind of continues the story. And then the first partner comes back and brings in the experience that he's just had it with the phone.
Yeah.
So he talks about the phone relays this information to us, and then we relay the information that comes through the phone. So we become in this endless, like, reciprocal relationship with the technology. So if you think about that, then obviously the way we feel about ourselves and the way we process emotional experience is also working through these technologies. And we see this all the time in social media, don't we? And the kind of strangeness of things like Snapchat filters for kind of changing the way that we represent ourselves and so on. So I'm really interested in how we can use psychoanalysis to understand what's at stake there, mm-hmm. and to therefore understand how we might be reworking or we need to rework our understanding of the human mind and unconscious experience and emotional experience and how it's getting processed and manipulated and repurposed through all of this experience.
That's really interesting. I think it's, I think like conceptually we still think about like computers and media and social media as kind of tools we use. And actually, it's kind of, I think it was Shelley Turk who wrote, it's not what computers do for us, it's what they do to us. Yeah. And, you know, we are all cyborgs now. I mean, we are kind of attached to our machines and our machines are inside of us and not just kind of physically like phones in our pockets. It's the it's that object relations. You know, they become objects in our minds, don't they? You know.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a really intimate objects as well, if you think about, you know, just in the proximity that we hold our phones close to our faces, we tuck them in our front jeans pockets, you know, they're really close to our bodies and our faces and in ways that other humans are not on the whole, you know, unless you're in a very intimate relationship with someone. So there's that intimacy and the kind of extraordinary fascination that these objects hold for us. You know, that we read so much, don't we, about the addictive properties of phones and various apps and social media experience and so on. But at the same time, we also hear a lot about the whittling down of our attention span. And so how, you know, everything is working at pace and everything is working at a kind of very kind of fleeting, ephemeral level of experience. And I don't think that's right. I think there's something about striving for a sense of an authentic connection and a real striving for something that feels real. And I know that, you know, I'm using that to you as a Lacanian and kind of thinking that's a dangerous word to bring in.
I remember when, mobile phones started appearing kind of en masse, and now you go to a rock concert or something and the phones would come out, and I started to really see how people's perceptions of kind of the here and now events were changing, that the authentic event seemed to be kind of how it was posted on Facebook later. You know, people found it very hard to be present. It was all about kind of the selfie at the show, or it's all about, I don't know what you think, but how it makes us performance sort of subjects. We become our own kind of performance artists and always on shows, on media, and which can be very creative, and it can kind of create a huge pressure on people and a fragmented kind of self.
Yeah, I think that you've hit the nail on the head there. It's a brilliant example of what I'm talking about, because it raises a question, doesn't it, about where human experience actually lies. Like, if you're at a gig, you know, are you experiencing it in the moment, or are you actually only experience it once you get the likes online later on?
Yeah.
And which experience matters more, or do they actually both matter in different ways? And I think this is why I think psychoanalysis is useful, to come back to that both and kind of structure that we talked about before. I think it's both aspects of experience. And one thing that I've learned quite recently, actually, through my dropping into the new social media app Clubhouse, is of the existence of this new concept called the metaverse, which I'd never heard of before, where, you know, you're living life in boring old real life where we're all chained to Zoom and, you know, worrying about whether or not we can be heard properly or the internet is reliable enough. But at the same time, we've got this alternative parallel existence, which is sometimes happening at the same time and sometimes happening out of time and out of kilter with our real lives. And you can see that, can't you, when people are like stuck at bus stops and or on train stations and just absolutely mesmerized and don't seem to be in the world, you know, in the real world. So this hopping between different worlds or realms of experience I think is really fascinating, because where does the human lie in all of that? If we're going to think about human nature and the changes that are happening in human nature as this kind of relationship to technology and experience really embeds itself. So it's like, it's absolutely naturalized now, isn't it? It's like,
it's totally pervasive. And like you said, that naturalizes it kind of, particularly those who've grown up in the digital age, they are in this kind of metaverse. They are kind of just present in it. It's not something they question at all.
Yeah. Well, there's apocryphal stories, aren't there, of babies on buses trying to swipe the window, you know? Which always amused me. But I think our fascination with those kind of examples of babies and babies' experience of technology really speak to us about the depth of change that's happened and the way that we don't actually seem to have the tools to unravel this. I think another backdrop for it for me is always also that, you know, there's a lot around pandemics of anxiety and pandemics of loneliness and so on. And this particularly being the case for young people, Gen Z kind of people, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of interested in how those emotions of anxiety, loneliness kind of speak to something that's missing in real life and speak to the lack of actual contact in community, you know, family groups, neighborhood groups and so on. And the way that contact is presented in a kind of alternative or illusory way through our contacts online. And so there's something very important, I think, in terms of recent psychoanalytic theory as well, around relatedness and relationality in all of this, which is another kind of conceptual theme that I like to try to hover over when I'm thinking.
Yeah, let me think about you, Caroline. I was thinking about the Lacanian concept of lack and the object patois, which covers lack. So we find lack painful. It points to our real, it opens up our desire, but we kind of like to cover it up. So we buy consumer goods to cover the lack we feel. We have all these attachments to communications. We can click on something very, very quickly the minute we feel lack and emptiness to get in the way. But I was reading somewhere about a Lacanian view of how the big other is taken out of the game in its new social kind of media world, that you can actually have endless jouissance, endless circular jouissance. So you can choose on Facebook, on social media, which group you attend, who you talk to, and you can always kind of get what you want. You can always kind of, if I want to believe in the conspiracy theory that kind of monkeys can fly, I can find someone on that internet which kind of to join my group. And you can always kind of always gain kind of satisfaction through this kind of multiverse in which we live, you know. And that takes out kind of the big other, but it leaves you deeply unsatisfied.
Absolutely.
Does that kind of make any sense to you? Any kind of thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I think it creates a kind of profound emptiness, doesn't it, inside? And I tried to write about this in an article that I wrote recently on binge watching, actually, and the fascination with binge watching. And I was thinking about how two very popular shows for binge watching were Mad Men and Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. And I found it really interesting that the main character, you know, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't watched the shows, but the main character of Breaking Bad obviously has a diagnosis of lung cancer that seems to be terminal. And one of the ensemble characters in Mad Men, Betty Draper, also eventually gets a diagnosis of cancer. And I'm really, really interested in what psychoanalysis talks about in relationship to the insides of bodies.
Yeah.
And the way in which these cavities get filled up by these alien diseases, you know, that fill up the emptiness inside. And of course, we do this through things like eating as well. We fill up the cavities inside. We do this when we breathe. We do this when, you know, if people smoke or vape, then they're filling up these empty cavities. And I think that in the thinking that I did around those shows and in relation to binge watching, I was thinking about how binge watching is alerting us to a profound sense of emptiness inside, the kind of dissatisfaction that you're referring to there, and our desire to fill it up. And so we devour these shows and we kind of can't stop ourselves. And it kind of, you know, Netflix has to become a kind of big other, doesn't it? You know, when it now kind of interrupts you and goes, the question is, are you still watching whichever show it is? Yeah, and I love that question because it's like, where's the emphasis? It sounds like, you know, your mum or something. Are you still watching that show?
Yeah, and that's very interesting. The emptiness and the connection to cavities. I hadn't kind of thought about it in that way before. The kind of physicality of that. The unconscious. People think about the unconscious as a kind of a mental thing, but of course, it's, you know, Lacanian psychoanalysis talks about it being in the body. It's all about the body, you know, and then, you know, we experience in the body. It's, you know, we can't separate kind of the conscious, unconscious experiences. You know, they're physical and bodily experiences, even though we're spending so much time on social media or in the virtual world. Our physicality is kind of is how we express things and how we feel things, you know.
Yeah. And of course, then, but that one of the attractions of the virtual world is also now that you can filter that. So you can, you know, there's been a lot of coverage over a long number of years now about Photoshop and how, you know, particularly female stars get Photoshopped so that they're more attractive or, you know, in inverted commas or glamorized or what have you. But of course, now there's this kind of seeming epidemic amongst young girls in particular around only posting photographs with Snapchat filters and this kind of flattening of a human face, the kind of the human face looking like something from anime rather than a real human face that you'd encounter in the street, and what that does to kind of self-perception, body dysmorphia, you know, all kinds of states of mental distress around identity and bodily experience, I think is very important. Yeah, I think there's a lot there in terms of the physicality of the body. But another reason that I enjoy the psychoanalytic is to come right back to Freud, you know, in one of his earliest pieces of writing in Studies in Hysteria, he wrote that, you know, the aim was to transform what he described as neurotic hysteria into common everyday unhappiness. Mm-hmm. That was the aim of psychoanalysis. And it seems almost as though we've lost the capacity to understand that mature human experience is inflected with everyday unhappiness, that that's normal. Yeah. And that there is this kind of ideal or idealized life that we're constantly encouraged to strive towards, that these degrees of perceived perception that are actually just an effect of neoliberalism and impossible to achieve. So there seems to be a kind of dangerous kind of, you know, this rock is rolling downhill at great pace. And where is it taking us in terms of the mental health piece and so on?
Yeah, no, I think it's really important. I mean, the other thing about psychoanalysis, people often think about it in terms of the individual and they kind of have an iceberg in their mind. You know, you have the ego at the top or your consciousness at the top, and then beneath that, your superego and your id and your unconscious, you know, that's the kind of classical idea people carry. But, you know, you and I both see it as a much more of a social understanding. So Freud wrote Civilization and His Discontents and Mourning and Melancholia. And these papers to me really kind of speak about kind of a more of a social cultural kind of a condition, which is shared. And I was thinking about how melancholic things are. I don't know, I've written about America being a melancholic state as it kind of loses its empire and doesn't quite know where it's going, and it kind of votes in Trump and stuff. And and it's a kind of the lack of mourning which goes on, because mourning is a deeply felt, you know, you have to go through kind of that emptiness, you have to go through that kind of huge grief. And yet it's much easier to kind of binge watch on Netflix to kind of interrupt that, or you know, whatever people do to interrupt it, you know, that we're left in a kind of ongoing state of melancholia, which is difficult to escape from.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely crucial. And there's very little space for mourning in our culture at the moment, I think. And obviously with the terrible experience of the past year around the globe, then it's ever more important to create these spaces for rituals and to ritualize this experience and to acknowledge the experience through, you know, commemoration and so on. It will be interesting to see how and where this unfolds and at what kind of rate of pace. I think the melancholic strain has been around for a while, and it's certainly been intensified a lot. I don't know if you've watched the film Joker. It's Joker.
I've seen bits of it. I haven't seen the whole thing.
It's an extraordinary film. I mean, I think it's in that camp of love it or loathe it. And, you know, I was really interested in the media response to it, because it was held up as, you know, a terrible film that was, it was an incel film, and it was going to wreak havoc. And, you know, it was incarnating the kind of values of the far right and this misogynistic kind of world that we live in. And actually, I think it's doing something very profound. It's putting on show the collapse of all that we've taken for granted, certainly in my lifetime, in terms of ideology and power structures, I think. And the way that that's imploding at the moment all around us, you know, it was imploding before the advent of the pandemic. It was certainly imploding around, and we saw this all over the place in terms of, you know, Brexit, the election of Trump, the kind of the rise of right-wing governments across Europe and around the world more broadly. I think we were beginning to see the late stages of neoliberalism and the implosion that was coming, and that this is kind of often attached to a particular kind of white masculinity. And I think Joker does a really good job of kind of bringing the underside of all of that, and the kind of panic and the really messy, complicated, unpleasant dimensions of that experience up for us to think about, and actually puts it in our faces and challenges to actually think about this stuff.
Yeah.
So I think that going alongside what you've said really helpfully there about melancholia, and, you know, your work on this is really important. There is also the need for us to kind of, as with any kind of melancholia, the need for us to kind of create space for it to be contemplated, to create space for it to be seen, acknowledged, in order for it to be thought and understood. And that, you know, I think it's another really important aspect of why a psychoanalytic critical set of thinking is so potentially rich, because it invites us to do the pausing and to stop racing ahead through time as though melancholia is all that there is. Invites us to kind of stop and think together. I think togetherness is something very important that we're missing, obviously, after the kind of experience of the pandemic and lockdowns everywhere and so on. But that togetherness and coming together to kind of represent and interrupt this melancholic process seems to be incredibly important right now.
Yeah. Another thing you write about a lot is the cinema and kind of the experience of being in a cinema. I was just, in talking to you, recalling an author, is it Laura Mulvey?
Yeah, Laura Mulvey, Laura's work.
Very powerful paper I read, and the effect of the gaze and the male gaze. And can you say something about that, the power of cinema and what it does to us and the gaze?
Yeah, sure. There's a whole load, I won't go into all of the details, there's a whole load of film theory that uses Freudian and Lacanian psychoanalysis to theorize the pleasures of cinema. And kind of talks about cinema as only this unusual space in our cultural setup, in that you know you buy something sticky and sweet and you go into a dark environment, you sit there and there's a projector at the back, you can't see the projector, so it's like watching dream images. And of course there are no images there. What we're watching is a play of light on a satin screen, you know. But we enter into this as a kind of illusion, and we act and respond to it as though it's real, and we get embroiled, don't we, and we identify and so on. And Laura Mulvey's work is around, you know, she makes it's a very seminal kind of piece of work published in 1975, where she argues that the gaze in cinema, Hollywood cinema, is always structured as male, because the director's male, the camera operator's male, the protagonist's often male. And there's been like 50 odd years of feminist debate subsequently about whether there's any such thing as a female gaze. And in some of my early work, I was using, I used a post-Lacanian philosopher in the feminine, she doesn't like the word feminist, to kind of think about cinema made by women and the way in which there was a lot of kind of big kind of blockbuster style films in the 90s. Films like The Piano and Orlando and things like that. So I was quite interested in how a particular set of cinematic experiences opened up a possibility for women to see aspects of their own gendered experience that aren't usually able to be put into words. Yeah. So I wrote a book around, I called it Feminine Cinematics, and I was thinking about the way that cinema kind of creates space for us to feel seen and recognised and to have our experience, are that unconscious kind of aspect of experience, brought up to the surface so that we're in contact with it. And to think about how that process kind of helps us to acknowledge who we are and changes who we think we are. And then later I did some work on very controversial filmmaker Lars von Trier, again, another love him or loathe him kind of figure, the famous, you know, enfant terrible of 20th century cinema. And he's a provocateur, really, isn't he? And
yes, he really is.
Yeah, I was quite interested in his work, but actually I drew my work on him to a close by thinking about how his own experience of very poor mental health ended up being mediated and becoming the substance of his own work in the very controversial film Antichrist. And actually, I think what the cinema does for us there is invite us to actually recognise somebody else's mental distress in a way that opens up space for us to contemplate our own mental distress and our own experience, and to think about how cinema might enable us to step into opportunities to, you know, seek help or actually reflect on our own psychological despair and how to make sense of it.
Yeah, I mean, he is a real provocateur, as you say. I remember bumping into him without knowing who he was when I saw the film The Idiots. I'm thinking, whoa, what is this?
So
challenging, like so gripping, and left you thinking, really pushed you to think hard about your own morals and what was going on, and mental health and mental illness and physical disability and all those issues.
Yeah. And I don't think it's just art cinema that does this. You know, I think art cinema obviously has this long history of, you know, working philosophically and with kind of big ideas and, you know, striving to be like other artistic encounters, something that causes us to pause and think and reflect. But I think this happens also in any common or garden kind of, you know, entertainment context. And if you think about the extraordinary success of the film Mamma Mia, the movie, I remember my own first encounter with that, and I was just so appalled. I was like, this is going to be terrible. It was somebody who really hated musicals. I was like, I don't think I can actually bear it. But actually what I found really interesting about that film, rather than the stage show, is the extraordinary use that people have made of it. So, you know, it just exploded culturally. So there would be like weekly screenings where whole family groups would go once a week, and we'd be dressing up, singing and dancing in the aisles, letting off steam, you know, expressing their friendship. And this wasn't just, you know, a one-off. It's global. It's absolutely global. The sing-along of Mamma Mia. And the DVD sales, you know, there's a copy in almost, I think it's like half the houses in the world have a copy of Mamma Mia, the movie, on DVD.
Wow.
So there's nothing there. You need to rush out quick, get yourself one online. There's something there, I think, about it's a profoundly, you know, it's a very trite, kind of silly piece of work in lots of ways, but it's hugely pleasurable, hugely joyful.
Yeah.
Something about the way that film can enable a joyful experience that really puts us in contact with who we are. And I think that the success of that film is really to do with the songs of ABBA and the way we get returned to early life experience or to experiences that are associated with close contact with family and friends, you know, wedding discos and so on.
Yeah.
We have a lot to thank ABBA for.
I think it's going to be very interesting to see how cinema does survive. I mean, there was a lot of predictions once you've got kind of your Netflix at home and stuff that kind of people would just sit at home and watch. And of course they do. And in their billions, but they also still go to cinemas. And that darkened space, that entering into that kind of a dreamlike state is still very compelling, isn't it?
It really is. And I think it's also a really rare opportunity, isn't it? Because you can go in a large group, you can go on your own, you can go in a couple, what have you.
You
always have your own individual experience.
Yeah.
You know, when you come out of the film and you've got a different experience to the person or people that you've gone with, it's always quite extraordinary to hear their experience and to kind of have some tangible proof of the way that we all have a life of the mind that relates to media in its own individual way. And coming back to von Trier, I remember very, very clearly 2011 when he released his film Melancholia, going to see that at a particular point in my life where I was quite sad.
Yeah.
And I could not speak about the film. I could not speak about my experience of it. And yet I couldn't get the images out of my mind. And it was 3 years until I could speak about it. When I was invited to speak about it as an academic, it forced me to think about why I couldn't speak about it. And that seemed to release something in my selfhood and in my mind around that particular emotionalized experience for me. So there is something quite therapeutic about cinema, I think.
There can be, yeah. I mean, some of his films I can't watch. I'm kind of some of the more challenging ones, but Melancholia was like, it's a mixture of depression and beauty, grief, and it's end of the world. Oh my God, it left me. I remember it. I walked out of that cinema kind of like, yeah. Just, you know, silence, like you say. It's like,
it's devastating, isn't it? I mean, but
it's beautifully devastating. It's like beautiful and devastating.
Yeah. It's like, it's a proper definition of the sublime, isn't it?
Yes.
You've reminded me that I was also quite interested in it at the start of the pandemic, that there was this sudden surge in a desire to watch end of the world media. Mm-hmm. So lots of people watching films like Contagion or, there's a French series on Netflix called Into the Sun, and other kind of zombie led kind of media. And I was at first appalled, thinking, what are people doing? You know, there's enough going on. The world's on fire outside our windows, you know. And then I thought about it and thought, actually, these end of the world media always have a happy ending. So there's something about an expression of hope and a wish, and actually a self-soothing kind of choice in the decision to watch this stuff that also speaks to us about what's going on in contemporary experience. So the media tells us a lot, I think, about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It tells us and it shapes us. I just want to ask you, you think quite a lot about psychoanalysis and power and social power and gender and diversity issues. And in the USA in particular, but in the West, there's this big shift towards kind of identitarian politics and identity being really kind of a rising up. And I just looked at a recent website in one of the corporations I'm working with, and they had the LGBTQIA, I think it was, with, you know, these different acronyms going on and on. And I wondered from a psychoanalytic point of view, what sense you make of the importance of identity and sub-identities and all the questions around gender and sexuality and just kind of the intense focus on it.
Yeah, it's a very interesting moment that we're living through, isn't it? With a profound kind of set of changes. And I think underlying it all is that kind of idea that I touched on earlier about the implosion of neoliberalism and the way in which that's taking a kind of, you know, the hegemonic kind of source of power out of the picture, you know, albeit at a kind of glacial pace. But we are kind of seeing an incipient collapse, I think, of things like the patriarchy and the neoliberal agenda and the kind of emphasis on capital, a certain shade of capitalism, at least. And I think what's going on is that there is a kind of opportunity in this kind of highly disastrous moment that we seem to be living through. You know, I'm not just thinking about the pandemic here, but I'm also thinking about climate emergency and the political emergency, the very kind of very split kind of and fixed kind of positions that we're seeing in our political arenas at the moment. You know, that the middle ground has been evacuated, hasn't it? And I think that when you're living in that kind of schizoid state, there is an opportunity for oppressed voices to kind of rise up, and those that have been othered to kind of be seen, because there is a kind of clutching around at experience and an opportunity to kind of make voices heard that haven't been heard before. And so, you know, I'm interested in the idea of not being able to breathe as a kind of key marker of our times. You know, whether that's in regard to the murder of George Floyd, or whether it's in regard to the murder of Sarah Everard, or to the extraordinary number of global deaths around COVID, not being able to breathe tells us something about the suffocating nature of ideology. And yet there are voices that are starting to be heard. And I think that there's something also coming to bay, you know, as someone who's worked with critical thinking, critical theory for 25 years or so now, there is, you know, the postmodern logic in theory was always everything is in flux, you know, nothing is fixed.
Yeah.
Everything is up for grabs, and we need to see ourselves as fluid individuals, pluralistic kind of bodies and identities. And actually, I think that's what we're seeing being made real at the moment.
Yeah. You know,
in the context of the LGBTQ plus settings, then there is an idea of non-binary, which I find extremely interesting. You know, in some ways, by definition, we all ought to be queer or non-binary, because that would give us more scope to actually flex and flux in our lives, and perhaps enjoy more creative lives as a result. And the kind of changes that are happening, which are so urgent around social responsibility, I also find very interesting, you know, the idea that it's no longer incumbent on people of color to do the labor around making space for experience of people of color to be witnessed and seen and acknowledged and actually addressed and made valuable, that this is the work of white people. And that's extraordinary for white people to actually be placed in that position of responsibility. So there's an urgent invitation and an urgent need for us all to step into that with willing hearts and open minds, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, I think your analogy of not being able to breathe, I mean, that also speaks of the climate crisis and the pollution and stuff. It's that really resonated with me, and the suffocating ideology. And I mean, I did a podcast with a friend on queer culture, and it's, I mean, for me, the kind of queer ideology is actually one of the great hopes of our times. It's like, you know, it actually speaks to our times, and it speaks to kind of a post-modernity, because modernity wanted to kind of have these clear boundaries between kind of male and female, and between kind of rich and poor, and between classes. And it was all about division of labor, and that was supposedly kind of about progress, and yet it's left us in quite a big suffocating mess.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also, I do, you know, the queer analogy also makes people precarious and left behind, and you get kind of as we know from psychoanalysis, when people feel anxious and under pressure and fearful, then their defenses come up, and you get cries to build walls and to lock people up, and we're seeing all that playing out, aren't we?
Yeah, I think we are. But I read something that gave me hope yesterday, which was, I think, in the Guardian newspaper, a podcast, which I haven't had time to listen to the podcast, but I read the article that accompanied it, about how the experience of the past year on all those fronts that we've mentioned, Black Lives Matter, you know, the increasing kind of levels of misogyny around the world, climate crisis, the kind of terrible political environment and so on, is having the effect of politicizing the young generation. Mm-hmm. And that there's a new kind of level of activism emerging amongst Gen Z people, which I find, you know, having worked with young people for a long time, to be absolutely refreshing, because there's been an absence of interest in the political in my professional life for a long, long time. So to have that come back feels really, really exciting and full of hope for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've got a paper coming out this month, actually, on the meaning of Greta.
And, I can't wait to read that. That sounds fab.
Psychoanalytical insights into kind of the social meaning of Greta. So I'll send you that.
Wonderful. Exactly what we need.
I enjoy doing that research. But like you say, she expresses kind of a lot of kind of that activism and hope and of that generation. And I think that's really important. We're running out of time. We could go on forever. It's really interesting talking to you, Caroline. I ask my guests at the end of each podcast if they have anything to say to the audience on how to live a good life or the meaning of a good life and creating a good society. Anything from your experience which might help.
Two tiny questions there.
Ambitious project we're on.
Fabulous questions. I think in terms of living a good life, I've always held in mind a wonderful book that I read a long time ago by a sociologist called Ian Crabbe, who wrote a book, I think it was 1994, called The Importance of Disappointment. And I think that actually, harking back to that idea of being able to tolerate everyday unhappiness and being able to understand that disappointment is a huge opportunity for learning and also development, is really important for me as a life lesson in how to strive to live a good life. And then in terms of the good society, I think there's something in this piece that we've just been talking about around social responsibility. Mm-hmm. And for me, I don't often return to the work of Lucy Rigorai these days, but I do on this because she has this wonderful concept which she's interested in ideas of gender, but I think this applies across the board. She refers to the need for respect for the radical irreducibility of the other. And I think that is potentially one of the most powerful concepts for us at the moment in terms of reorganizing our sense of social structures, our sense of social responsibility, and our sense of how the balance of power is in shift and what might need to come out of that. So, yeah, I think those two concepts would be the organizing principles for me, if they make sense.
Beautiful, yeah. I mean, the irreducibility of the other, in layman's terms, don't box people into boxes. Anybody can be many different things.
Yeah, absolutely. And also for the fact that, you know, I think there is a tendency, isn't there, for us to, as you say, box people in, pin people down, and we make fixed assumptions about who people are. And we always need people to give people wriggle room. We always need people to give people room to address the offences that they've caused, or, you know, the mistakes that they have made, and to grow and learn in the same way that we have to allow that space for ourselves.
Yeah, and that aligns to Lacanian psychoanalysis, of course. One by one, you know, each subject is absolutely kind of unique in the society. So, listen, this has been lovely talking to you. Very, very interesting. I'm sure the audience will love this. So, thank you very much for your engagement.
It's been such a pleasure, Simon. I really appreciate the invitation. It's just so great to have time to talk with you about these things. Thanks very much. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like further information about our coach and leadership training, or would like to join our advanced community of practice where we discuss edgy ideas and much, much more, please contact me, Simon@analyticnetwork.com.